Saddle up, partner.
This is the Voices of the West.
Welcome to Emil Franzing's Voices of the West, dedicated to the principle that America was better off when our TV shows featured cowboys instead of lawyers.
Welcome to Emil Franzing's Voices of the West. Today, something a bit different. Todd Roberts and I had an opportunity to travel to the Central California Coast wine country to interview Dana Merrill. He's a seventh-generation Californian whose family came to the region in the 1840s. The family raised cattle and sheep and dabbled in agriculture as well. Well, Dana's now the owner of the Pomar Junction Vineyards and Winery, situated near Paso Robles. He sat down with us to share his family's history and talk about the wine industry. We're talking about some history, some wine, and whatever else happens to cross our mind. You want to start it off?
Sure. This is Todd Roberts here for Voices of the West. And as Harry Alexander said, we're talking to Dana Merrill. This is a seventh generation land grant holder through his family, and a lot of history, not only through Templeton, but Paso Robles and Los Olivos, Santa Barbara County, and so on. And you've got not just history of those days in the Wild West, as California was, but also into the present day as modern day, shall we say, grape ranchers.
And we should indicate, yeah, we are in California.
We are in California, and where there is still a little bit of Wild West left. I think with this amount of history and lineage and going back this far and the stories of struggles and so on, successes and failures, I think is more than enough enjoyment for the hour. So let's proceed. Dana, why don't you just introduce yourself and just talk about where you started and how you got to be where you're at today.
Well, that's a good question. Basically, I had the good fortune to be born in Santa Barbara County into a family that had a lot of regard for history and our heritage. And although a lot of the grandness of thousands of acres that once the family once owned weren't part of the picture anymore, the stories and the connection of the land remained. And my parents did an excellent job in making us aware. One of four kids, and all of us have a real keen interest in our heritage, so that's been special. I was lucky enough to grow up on a family farm. It was small, but it was very effective in ingraining in us a real love for the land and growing crops and raising animals. And, you know, sometimes they're more fun than others, but you know, going out to see sheep lambing in a rainstorm with my grandfather, and you know, unfortunately, they don't all make it through that, but it's all part of life and learning how nature works and so on. And it I think has served me well. I've managed to find in the end analysis a way to make a good living being part of agriculture, and I'm very thankful for that, because there are not very many of us left that grew up on a farm that were able to either able to find a way to make a living in agriculture, or perhaps were even interested in doing it. So we notice that all the time when we interview people for jobs in our current ag company, that most of the time now these folks grew up in cities, and they might have had a grandfather that was on a ranch, but you just don't see the tide of the land anymore. So I feel very fortunate.
The family history also revolves around agriculture as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's several sides to the family. We were talking about an Irish grandmother coming from Ireland to Boston, and that's part of it. But the side that we tell the most stories about, of course, is going back to the early mission days. I mean, literally, my ancestors came to Baja. I mean, there were some of them in Baja for 400 years before they ever moved up into California. A lot of people don't realize that, how long Spain was in the New World before they really ever even started to do anything in California. And I've had my relatives were in the Portola expedition. One was an engineer for Father Serra's group to come north and build missions. And of course, that grew into the Rancho period, which we still have a fondness for. I know my brother and I both, and we had a little bit of it last night, a barbecue and and the fellowship, maybe it's not, on a trail ride around the campfire, but it's a lot of the same feel. You're on a ranch and you're cooking meat over a fire, and you obviously have to have a nice glass of wine to go with it. And I never thought much about being in the wine business, which I'm in now, but when I look back at the old adobes in San Ynez and so on, I mean, there was a grape arbor there. It was believed to be about 300 years old. They got trunks that are like a foot across, and they'd make their own wine. Long before Prohibition, and probably went on right when Prohibition was going, because you had to have a drink for medicinal purposes and nothing else. And anyway, it's a heritage that's hard to appreciate if you didn't grow up close to it. And I think for us, hearing the stories of my grandparents, but my grandfather, in his own words, would tell us stories of what it was like to grow up. He was born in 1887, but he could remember very clearly what it was like for his father growing up under his father, born in 1852, and then the fellow that built the adobe in 1852 in Santa Ynez, Dr. Don Ramon de la Costa. Of course, he was born in Santander, Spain, and received a medical degree, eventually emigrated to Los Angeles, and then found his way up to buy land, because there's supposed to be some great land deals in this new country called what eventually became Santa Barbara County. I'm not sure, I guess it wasn't a county then, but they followed the missions up. And after the mission lands, a lot of the ranchos were beginning to try to get, they wanted people to come and settle the land. They wanted to get some business going, and they wanted to make something happen. And so they came to raise cattle, sheep, not a lot of farming there, mostly livestock type things. But that history is still with us today. I mean, it's a big part of our lives, even though we literally aren't doing the same things that they did in 1850.
Share some of the stories that your grandfather told.
Yeah, well, we were talking about that. There's several of them. I mean, I'll try to do this somewhat in chronological order, but of course, a major event in California's history is when, as we got to the end of the, after the gold rush by 1850, California was about to become part of the United States. And you have to remember, in those days, in my family, they all spoke Spanish. I mean, nobody spoke English. I mean, Spanish was the language of California. There's people that are chagrined about how much Spanish is spoken today, but it was that's what people spoke in California. In fact, I would bet you that my great-grandfather certainly spoke Spanish first and learned English. My grandfather was fluent in both. My mom was fluent in Spanish as well.
Weren't all of the governors of California Spanish or of Spanish heritage until 1885, 1890?
This was definitely part of it. In fact, my grandmother was going to have my story I was going to say, but my grandmother from Ireland through Boston, she had some years where she wasn't well, had to go to the hospital and everything. I had to recover back at the ranch. And so my mother was an only child, Elenita de la Costa, was raised by her aunts, who were the children of Don Ramon that built the adobe. And when my grandmother was finally able to take my mom back home again and raise her, mom only spoke Spanish because the aunts only spoke Spanish. I mean, they could make do in English. In fact, the aunts eventually made do pretty well because they ended up being teachers in colleges and everything else. And obviously, it was all in English by the time the University of California came along, the only campus being in Berkeley, by the way, in those days. So, Spanish was was the main language for sure. And it is kind of ironic to see it that way back again. I mean, there's parts of, you get northern Monterey County, you don't even need English for any utilitarian use. But if we go back to 1848 or so, the big news in Santa Barbara County was, of course, General Fremont moving south to eventually capture Los Angeles. But on his way, he went through Monterey, and he went through, rode through the Paso Robles area, but there wasn't much here in those days. And
how far north is Paso Robles from where we're at here in Templeton?
Well, how far is Paso Robles from Templeton?
Yeah, just up
5 miles.
Yeah,
it's not very far.
Up the road,
yeah, it's not very far. But Fremont, you know, the big land grant ranchos were also major way stations in those days. And so my great-great-great-grandfather, William Goodwin Dana, who is was a clipper ship captain and ended up marrying into a California family, he built a large adobe in Napomo, which is just north of Santa Maria. In fact, the adobe is there, and it's restored. It's really a nice historical visit for people. But he, you know, he ended up with 23 kids, and he was big land grant and cattle and all that stuff. Well, Fremont was riding through, and apparently he had run into a little trouble in Salinas or maybe a little bit north towards San Jose, and he lost about half his horses. Also, it took, I understand, it took like three sets of horses for a riding soldier. They had to have them and rotate them, mm-hmm. apparently. And so, anyway, they got to Napomo, and they needed more horses. And so Captain Dana was in a cooperative mood. I mean, he was an American, but he had married into the Spanish family. But I think he knew that there was an inevitability about the United States taking over California, and it probably just as well served to reduce the bloodshed through cooperation if you could. So he gave Fremont 25 horses or so, and told him to take off. But what happened was they also took the family's prized horses, which were not offered, and the family wasn't real thrilled about that. But the soldiers took off, and they went south just east of Santa Maria, and on a road called Fox and Canyon Road, which is actually wine country, wine trail right now. And they were camping there. And so what the vaqueros from the Dana Ranch did was they took what's called the bell mare with them. The bell mare had a bell around its neck, and the bell mare was used to bring all the stock home when they were out grazing out in the hills. They took the bell mare down there, snuck up, and at night untied all the halters from the rope there, and the bell mare led all the family horses and all the rest of them, led them all back to Napomo. So when the soldiers got up in the morning, there were no horses. So like I was saying, I don't know that somehow they still managed to take Santa Barbara without bloodshed. So it didn't slow them down too much.
But
it's an interesting story about that.
No word that they came back for horses, is there? They just moseyed on.
Went and got them from somebody else, yeah. I guess, and they didn't come back to the Danas. But that's kind of interesting. And of course,
went to bed, cavalry woke up as infantry.
exactly. And if you go between Santa Maria and Los Olivos, there's a monument to where Fremont camped. That's right along the county road there, Fox and Canyon Road. That's kind of an interesting area, because when you go back there, it doesn't look like 101 or anything like you see today. You go back there today, and it's a paved county road, but you can kind of feel what it was probably like then, much less populated than the greater San Jose Valley. Now it has lots of horse ranches and everything. It's really, really pretty.
So were grapes being grown at that time?
Well, the Padres brought grapes with them, mm-hmm. you know, and raised, you know, I mean, obviously they needed sacramental wines, but I think they also needed wine to go with their meals, shall we say.
Yeah.
So, you know, really today we still have the Mission grape as a variety. I mean, it's a variety, and it was probably brought from Spain and planted, and some of the missions still have it. Of course, there's a root louse that wiped out the industries a few times called phylloxera, and Mission grapes are not resistant to phylloxera. So if they're grown anywhere where there's other grapes, phylloxera is just about everywhere. So phylloxera can't kill them, because where they planted them here, there was no grapes within, you know, millions mm-hmm. of miles almost. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, yeah, no, they raise it and they would make wine for their own use. And then my grandfather has stories later when they would also were pretty adept at using a still to make, you know, distilled spirit, shall we say, and although generally law-abiding, I'm sure they didn't stop producing in the Prohibition years. Yeah, yeah. So Fremont's the oldest one I can think of. Another one that we were talking about, I think, is kind of a fun story. So you jump up now, probably, I'm guessing, to the maybe 1880s or so, and so this would be Don Ramon's son, which was named Eduardo, so that would be my grandfather's father. By then, he was old enough that he was going. They used to run lots of cattle. In fact, a lot of the cattle where you folks rode on a train, all the coho and all that stuff, they used to lease all that. They used to run big cattle herds all across all of that stuff there.
Well, we saw a sprinkling of cattle once in a while, up to maybe 5 head and so on. But I did notice on your ranch, or maybe it's your neighbor, there are 2 Texas Longhorns.
That's my neighbor. I was wondering if you guys would see that. Yeah, isn't that something? Yeah. That's my well driller neighbor. Has those.
You can't miss those guys.
They were both lounging like
they're pretty
the pool.
Docile, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, like they're at the pool at Caesar's.
Yes, I know.
The expression on both of their faces was, we're not moving for anything.
Yeah. And they live in that old almond orchard just clinging to life. Uh-huh. A few of the trees that are left. Yeah, that's kind of a throwback picture right there. Yeah, yeah, that's pretty funny. But anyway, they would, you got to remember in those days, too, that if you lived in Santa Ynez or anywhere down that way, I mean, the only town that you could do any businesses was Santa Barbara. I mean, Santa Maria, there was not much going on in Santa Maria in those days. But so to go to Santa Barbara, you wouldn't hop a bus or go down the freeway or even go on a train. You'd get on your horse, or maybe there'd be a buckboard or something to ride. And then there were some stages too that I guess were pretty adventurous from Las Olivas to Santa Barbara. There's some pretty good stories about those. But but basically when they went to get all my stories all mixed up here. Let's talk about Eduardo. So I got 2 stories about Eduardo. One was, as we're on to talk about going over the hill to Santa Barbara, we'll divert to that story. There's a story where he was at one time riding over the hill, and he stopped to, I'm not sure for what, maybe just take a break, shall we say. And anyway, he ran right into another guy on a horse, and it turned out that guy was Solomon Pico, who was a famous bandit. And Solomon Pico wanted to know who he was, and so he said, well, I'm, Eduardo de la Costa. And he said, oh, you guys are the ones that have the adobe up in Buell. Yeah, okay. So the De La Costas were on one side of the river, and the Buell family, which is another old family that gave its name to Buellton, where across the river on the other side. So anyway, he said, yeah, I'm up there. He says, oh, you're all right. You've helped me out before, because these bandits and other people, they'd use these big rancho places as way stations, and not a lot of law and order, so you worked your own relationship to survive with people, whether it's the bandit forging his relationship or you as the ranchero, because the bandit would also probably make sure that other bandits didn't come along and steal all your cattle, because that would kind of park. So it's almost kind of a security service.
Good protection.
Exactly. So you get a little more out of it than just being a nice guy, let him stop in for a while. But I guess after they surprised each other when they met, and they scared the crap out of each other, and then he realized who Mr. De La Costa was. And then apparently he rode with Mr. De La Costa all the way down to the bottom where Refugio Beach is, where 101 has, rode him all the way down to the bottom, and then said, I'll let you go on your way, and he turned around and disappeared in the brush, and that was it. So, and I don't think my great-grandfather ever saw him again, but
did he know
an interesting story.
Did he know who the guy was?
Yeah. And so I think fairly notorious for around here anyway.
We'll be back with more stories about Dana Merrill's family right after this.
Emil Franzi's Voices of the West will be right back.
The Tucson Trap and Ski Club dates from 1948 and is now at 7800 West Old Ajo Highway. The club owns 80 acres and leases 300 more from Pima County that supports 50 trap fields, 15 skeet fields, 2 5-stand fields, 2 sporting plays courses with 12 stations each, a 9,000 square foot clubhouse, 200 full service RV hookups for members, and free Wi-Fi. This expansive facility gives enough room to host major national and international events annually, bringing thousands of people to the community. Check it out at TucsonTrapAndSki.com.
Can you even imagine switching back to pen and paper to run your business? Every year, we become more and more dependent upon our technology. If your network is not set up properly, you're just one click or one email away from losing data critical to your operation. Arizona Computer Guru offers a host of services to prevent and protect you from disaster. From online backup services to email filtering to fully managed network services, Arizona Computer Guru is here to keep your network secure, your data safe, and your budget in the black. To schedule your free consultation, call 304-8300.
The American Legion honors our newest generation of warriors and veterans.
Please join us in supporting and recognizing their unique contributions and needs.
The unemployment rate among veterans is unacceptably high.
They are a proven commodity, and they deserve a chance to get back to work after serving their country.
Hire them. Today, more than ever before, women are on the front lines of America's defense.
They deserve to be recognized for their service as guardians of freedom and to receive the best treatment and care we can provide.
Let's not forget our wounded warriors and their families as they return home. We cannot allow them to be forgotten and left to fend for themselves.
They deserve more.
And let's honor the families who sacrifice so much every day.
As the service member serves,
so does the family.
Please join with the American Legion to find out how you can truly honor America's newest generation of veterans. Go to legion.org/honorveterans to find out more.
Welcome back to Emil Franzink's Voices of the West.
Welcome back to Emil Franzink's Voices of the West. We're talking with Dana Merrill, a seventh-generation Californian, about his family's history in the region. And now another story about the Wild West days of the California wine country.
The other story with Eduardo was that they would go buy these cattle as far away as Texas and different places. And I know one time there was a story where my grandfather loved telling a story, and he'd just laugh like hell. He'd have a high laugh. And let me tell this story. But they were coming back riding horses, and it was just pouring rain in the around Hemet. And, you know, a real dry area, but you get these summer thunderstorms. Mm-hmm. And I think it's raining like a son of a gun. And so they finally are riding up, and they've got their leather, raincoats and different things they got on, trying to hats and everything, just going along. And finally they get to this place where there's a fire inside, and there's people inside this what passes for a town, I guess. And they went inside, and there was a big fire around a big stove. And as my grandfather put it, there were about 12 toughs, you call them toughs. There were 12 of these toughs sitting around the stove there, all sitting next to each other. So the vaquero, the Mexican fellow, worked for the ranch, great big guy, comes in. And my grandfather, all of my grandfather's family were, being Spanish, they're little. I mean, I'm tall because I think I got it from the McCarthys, but everybody else was like 5'5" was extremely tall. Wow. You know, 5 foot was about what most of them are. In fact, we got some of the little beds in the family, and these little beds are about as big as this desk.
Wow.
These people slept in. Yeah. So anyway, he comes in there, you know, and so I said, Mr. Del Cusso, would you like to sit by the fire? He says, no, I don't want to be in any trouble. I don't want to sit. He's not in trouble. I'll go talk to him. So the vaquero goes up and talks to these guys and says in Spanish to him, you know, would you be... I'd like to have a place to sit for me and mi amigo. And he takes up this knife that's about a foot and a half long and holds it up right next to one of the guy's cheek. And the guy looks at it, and it says mi amigo.
Oh my!
And they looked at that thing, and they looked at this guy, and he said they got up and they all ran out the door. And so he says, and so then just my God, what did you tell him? He said, I just wanted a little bit of room by the fire for myself and my amigo. So anyway, my grandfather laughed his head off at that story. He thought that was the best story.
Yeah, start naming my knives now.
That's a classic.
Yeah, that's
great.
A pretty good one. Yeah, no doubt about it.
Tell a story about the explosion.
Yeah, that's a great story. And I even looked it up on the internet to make sure that it wasn't just family folklore and all that. Because this one is new. This one is a little newer. And my grandfather, who I remember very, very well, I mean, he grew up right on a ranch, and it's where the Rodeau Winery is now, if anybody's been to San Ynez, right on Alamo Potato Road, which means the ranch of the Painted Cottonwood. And as my grandmother Eileen would always say, the road was named after the ranch, so, you know. And in any event, there was a well driller in Las Olivas. This was long before Las Olivas is the wine tasting room of the capital of California. And it was just a town mainly populated by Midwestern folks that came out, shop people and some ranchers and that kind of a thing. And the big ranchers would come to town. There was a meat market where the owner, Mr. Montanaro, would literally drive around a horse-drawn wagon and deliver meat to people, you know, a couple of times a week, you know, with ice packed in the... And people would bring their butchered stock, and he'd hang it, a big hook in a trolley thing that would bring these big things around, and he'd pick that thing up and pull that thing up there, put the hook on it, and... Anyway, interesting. It's funny. When you start these stories, you start to remember some other ones. But anyway, in Los Olivas, there's this fellow that was, they called him a genius. Sam said, there's no question he was a genius, an inventive genius. And he would, he was a well driller, but apparently he could do lots of fascinating things. So anyway, at about the same time, there was a blacksmith named, I think the name was Fairbanks, I think. And he was basically despised by the town because he was a terrible guy. I don't know if he was mean to kids, what he did, I don't know. Just not a pleasant personality,
he had the,
I guess.
The inane ability to unify the entire town. Yeah. The only issue that ever got the town to vote all one way,
yes.
Which was to hate him.
Yes. So apparently, next door to the blacksmith shop was a store, which is the Downs store, D-O-W-N, the name of the people were Downs. And that, I think it's still called the Downs store. It's probably a gift shop now, but it was a grocery store even in the 60s when the school bus would go around and take us home. The Downs store was there. Anyway, the guy with the Downs store got in an argument with the blacksmith, and it led to some level of fisticuffs, and the blacksmith got the press charges against the guy with the store, and the guy with the store lost, had to go to jail for 30 days. And that didn't do anything to lower the temperatures there. So when the store owner got out, he vowed revenge against this guy, the blacksmith. So the way the story goes is that the store owner...
And this was 1920s?
Yeah, 24. Okay. So, I mean, the trial was in 24. It's talking like 1923, so relatively recent, you know.
And after the World War I and in the height of the Prohibition, which also could have led to the discontentment of the town.
Exactly. Well, to this day, there's a flagpole right in the middle of the street. A lot of them were built right after World War I, and that one, a lot of them are gone because people run into them in cars and stuff. But in Los Olivas, it's still in the middle of the street. And so anyway, they hatched a plan to deal with this guy, and apparently it involved a lot of dynamite. And one morning, there was just a hellacious explosion and blew up the entire blacksmith shop and the store and everything else. And when it was done, the blacksmith was found blown to a million pieces, dead. And so then the authorities came out to check on this, the sheriff or constable, whatever we had in those days, and they discovered a meticulously built tunnel that ran from the vicinity of the store. I'm sure that would be the best place to do it,
right,
if you know, end up being a prime suspect. But it went over to exactly where the blacksmith always either worked or sat or something. It was perfectly placed. And so anyway, they figured this all out. So the guy in the store gets charged with murder. And it didn't take very long before they start figuring out, well, who's the only mind in Los Olivas that could possibly do something like this? And they came up with Stone Barger. Who else could build a tunnel, figure out how to build the charge and do all this stuff? So Stone Barger got hauled in. And just looking at some of these old clippings that, on the facts, which are basically what you can find on the internet, basically Stone Barger ended up going through 100 hours of interrogation, much of it like the controversial enhanced techniques that you hear about now, even though it was 1924. He was apparently turned upside down. They did something with water to him. This guy. And finally they broke him, I guess. Finally, after 100 hours.
Well,
somehow they got him to not say he killed the guy, but that he was intimately involved. And so the thing went to court, went to Santa Barbara, and it was the trial. My grandfather called it the trial of the century. And this was you know, 40 years before O.J. Simpson's trial, but it was the equivalent in Santa Barbara County. This was a big deal. And apparently, it was another name, this Downs family, the people with the store weren't particularly wealthy, but they were tied in with people that were. And so they got back to that. The guy that probably financed it is the cattleman Downs, that's related to the people in the store. So he got in trouble.
Oh,
so this trial started up, and it looked like Stonebarger was going to get fried for sure. But anyway, apparently once he got an attorney, the attorney started saying, you know, you can't use these enhanced techniques. And the other interesting thing is that one of the first uses of a lie detector machine was for this. A guy had just invented in Los Angeles, decides to come up here, a detective, and test it out on old Stonebarger. And apparently Stonebarger did not come out well on the test. So, but anyway, but the attorney attacked all of it, like this is a newfangled invention. How do we know this even works?
Yeah.
And it worked pretty well, and it got Stonebarger to change the story a little bit. That the only thing he did was unwittingly deliver the dynamite to another man named Crawford. And Mr. Crawford was actually the man who had hatched the whole plot. So Crawford somehow got sold down the river and took the fall for the whole thing. And Stonebarger was an accomplice. But when it all got done with, they couldn't find any witnesses who would testify. And the jury would not vote to convict, and so the whole damn bunch of them got off scot-free. And all because, like you said, the community basically agreed on one thing. This guy was a bad guy. The problem was resolved, and we all go on.
Yeah, there was harmony afterwards. But, of course, you know, when you're talking about those intense interrogations, you know, if you watch a lot of the old film noir, you know, the cops, you know, they always talk about the phone book and the rubber hose.
Yeah.
So, and that's part of it. And a big hot light on you. So I can just imagine 100 hours of a phone book, a rubber hose, and a hot light. You could get me to do about anything.
Yeah, right.
So I could just imagine he was ready to sing.
And it's in these papers, like the Oakland newspaper and the Orange County Register. And so it isn't the, you know, little paper in San Ynez or the Santa Barbara News Press or whatever it was then. I mean, this was a big story in California to blow up this thing and, you know, build the bomb and all that. So there's some notoriety for Las Olivas there. And he went on to drill a lot of wells. We're trying to figure out how old Stonebarger must have been. When I met him, when I was probably, you know, like a third grade or something like that, the guy seemed like he was about 80 years old. So he was probably in his 20s when he built this thing and blew up the thing. So he was a sharp kid. You got to give him credit for that.
Any evidence that he drilled wells for your family?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, when they used the old, they didn't have a boring deal. Where they just drop this thing. I'm trying to think what the hell they call it. You slam it in the ground and then dirt gets in. You bring it up and you dump it.
Yeah,
it's a, you can go down about 100 feet or something like that. But cable rig, they call it, I think. Yeah, where they just drop a big heavy thing and it gets a bunch of dirt in it and you pull it out. Yeah, yeah, that was a pretty good. That's one of my favorite stories. And of course, we always kind of wondered, you know, some of those stories. You know, I mean, was that literally what happened? You know.
We'll be back with more after these messages.
Emil Franzi's Voices of the West will be right back.
When looking for a property management company, here are some things you should consider. How long has the company been in business? What types of properties can they manage for you? And does the company give back to the community? Well, your search is over. The Polash Management Company meets and exceeds those considerations. They've been in business in Tucson, Arizona since the 1960s. They manage all types of properties throughout Arizona and elsewhere, from residential to commercial to public sector properties. The Polash Management Company also dedicates its time and resources to numerous community projects, including help funding the drive for the USS Arizona Memorial at the University of Arizona. You also want a property management company that puts you, the customer, first. Contact the Polash Management Company today at polashmanagement.com and ask about the complete package or call 520-795-2100. That's 520-795-2100. The Polash Management Company. Property managers you can trust.
You know, one way to really tell if you're at a restaurant that really cares about the food it serves, if it has one, check the bar. You don't have to be much of a drinker to know which liquors are quality. That's why you can tell that Highfalutin, that rapid-fire Western grill at 6780 North Oracle, just south of Ina, really takes pride in what it does by the quality of the liquor it serves and the beer on tap. The choices at the bar are as broad as the menu at Highfalutin, and even the well drinks are more than acceptable. Unlike some places where they just come with a barcode. If a restaurant doesn't care about the quality of its drinks, they've cut corners on the food. Highfalutin never has cut either and never will. Highfalutin, 6780 North Oracle, open daily for lunch and dinner with great sandwiches, salads, pastas, steaks, and comfort foods like pot roast and meatloaf, and even for an occasional drink.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
No doubt you've heard about rescue groups for dogs and cats, but did you know there's a rescue group for horses? That's right, it's called Horse It Around Rescue. Founders Steve Boyce and Teresa Worrell are helping out all those equine victims of neglect and cruelty by giving them a place to restore their health and wellness. And Horse It Around provides a nurturing and natural environment where horses can be horses, so they can be adopted out into forever homes. More than 120 horses, mules, and donkeys have been adopted out, but like everything else, it costs money to run the project. Horse It Around is a 501c3 nonprofit located in Southeast Arizona. Your tax-deductible donations to Horse It Around will go a long way so those horses can be horses. Check out the website, horseitaroundrescue.org. Make a difference in a horse's life. That's horseitaroundrescue.org.
Hi, I'm Wyatt McCrae, grandson of Joel McCrae, and you're listening to Voices of the West.
Welcome back to Emil Franzink's Voices of the West.
Welcome back to Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander here with Todd Roberts. We're talking with Dana Merrill, whose family settled in the region back in the 1840s. Now another story about the past of the California wine country.
You know, you get the stereotype of the Chinese cook like in Bonanza, right? Well, it turns out my family, and we talked about this, they were riding pretty high into the before the 20s, you know, and actually a lot of farmers made a lot of money in World War One selling beans and
stuff.
Exactly how we managed to, like, pick it, that's the time we went downhill. I don't know. I mean, the family doesn't really talk about it too much. I don't know exactly what happened, but in any event, what they basically said was we were more attuned to the Rancho period and the grand, you know, your Mikasa, Sukasa, and barbecues and trail rides, and not really equipped for. Okay, now we got an income tax, and you know, now we got to get a little more serious about things, you know. The cowboy
way was disappeared.
Well, my grandfather and his father. Remember, my grandfather told me, you know, I can go anytime I want to the Bank of America. My dad was a friend of AP Giannini. If I ever need any money, I can go there. Which turned out not to be true. But, you know, yes. Until they think maybe you can't pay it back. Then they're not.
There was a time that it was probably true.
Yeah.
But there's a time, you know, now where it's not true anymore.
Exactly.
Because of progress and so on.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the Chinese cook, I think, is a very interesting story. So please continue.
Well, they had a Chinese cook. And the Tong Wars broke out. Which were big in the big cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco and so on. And I'm thinking my brother thought it was probably around 1916, somewhere in there. But the Chinese cook was named Jin Kun, and he had to be hidden for I guess a few weeks. They hid him in the wine cellar. They were absolutely convinced that the tongs were coming to get the guy. His name was on a list, and he was going to be hit by somebody. It never happened, but I remember the aunts and everybody were you know, trying to hide him so that he couldn't be killed, you know. And
However safe he felt, I'm sure, hiding in the wine cellar, the family, I'm sure, felt very safe putting him there, because they knew he wasn't going to drink any of the wine.
Exactly.
So it was a win-win, if you think about it.
Yeah. Pretty funny. And of course, in those days, the they talk about that adobe down there, and it was built with a big courtyard in the middle that was eventually was roofed over, and they had pretty big families and no schools to go to, so they would actually literally teach school themselves to their own kids. I mean, a couple of the aunts that, you know, and all these families that were big families, there were also spinster aunts that never married, you know, and so there were a couple of school teacher aunts that, Aunt Tulita and Aunt Inez, that would teach all the other kids, and they had, there were cousins that were almost like brothers and sisters because cousins married cousins in the two families, so they were my grandfather said they were double cousins, closest thing to a brother and a sister. They were on the adjacent rancho, and that's right where you drive through Buellton before you get to the Nahui grade, you know, which is, you know, that's the whole 101 way to go south there, that they did that. My grandfather, when he went to high school, said, you know, there was no San Ynez High School. There were no schools, and eventually there was the beginnings of a high school. My grandfather literally would ride a horse from Buellton all the way to San Ynez. You think, well, that's not that far. Well, you know, it's probably a good 7 miles or so, which is not a short ride when you're talking about somebody that's, you know, maybe 10 years old, 11 years old, riding a horse with a couple of sandwiches and a saddle pack, and they got to cross the San Ynez River, which at times can flow quite a bit. And I guess on the times when it would, when it was too high to cross or if raining too much to come home, he would stay either at the mission or he would stay at the San Ynez Hotel, in which one of these big wooden hotels, like every big wooden hotel everywhere, it all burned down. But I mean, it was kind of interesting. You know, the other thing's kind of interesting too is because we're now starting to farm some properties down there on some of these ranches that go between the Indian Casino and San Ynez and the San Ynez River. And at one time, my grandfather was deeded 160 acres there by his father. I guess they were owed some money by the missions for overseeing their lands. The mission didn't have any money, so they gave him this 160 acres. And so the father gave it to my grandfather. And my grandfather says, that's a long way from Buellton. He gave it to his brother, who then lost it to, had a bar, I guess, and lost the damn thing. So anyway, we're farming. That 160 is part of a 1,000-acre project we got right now. And we're looking at this is in the heart of the San Ynez Valley. And my brother, and so I saw the chain of title. Yep, Sam Delapesta's name's right on there. And he got it one day, signed it over the next day in 1918. It's like, oh my God, how could
that is funny.
Yeah, well, like I said, we used to own where the Reagan Tip Top Ranch is. That's just right up the road from there. Right. We owned it all. Owned all that. Owned all where the Alice Al is, all of that stuff. We owned the whole thing. All the way to the Santa Rosa Adobe, which is halfway to Lompoc, which is now where the famous Santa Rita Hills Appalachian is. You know, those days it was cattle, and then it became beans, and then all of a sudden they discovered you could raise world-class Pinot Noir there. And so there's the La Vega Adobe. Then there's the one that's even older called the Santa Rosa Adobe. That's the one that's rumored to have gold coins buried under the walls or under the yard or something. Everybody's looked for it. That was buried in a big hurry when Fremont was coming. And it turns out he never even went to that place anyway. But wow. In the meantime, somehow they lost all the coins. Or someone else dug them up and they weren't there anymore or something. So that's the story. I mean, I don't know whether there's any coins that there aren't. But anyway, we actually have a lot of ties to adobe houses. And, you know, I've had the good fortune to, my grandfather's house is now the Rideau Winery that was built by two Englishmen. So it's a little bit different because it's two-story with a steep roof. And then we lived in one right below the San Ynez Mission. There was another family adobe. La Vega I never lived in, but that's the one that was built in 1852 by the medical doctor from Spain. And then the family he married into built the Santa Rosa one. That was actually built like in 1820. And that one's still standing too. Pretty amazing. You know, it's gone through earthquakes and, you know, no rebar and, you know, all this stuff.
Some how did they do that without the proper permit?
Well, you know what? Exactly. And my grandfather said they used to build them on rock foundations. They put all the stone there.
Yeah.
And it would absorb the shock. I don't know if that's real true or not. They're just lucky an earthquake didn't hit there. But yeah. Anyway. But it's still there. What the hell?
And the San Andreas Fault is running... Yeah. Not too far from where we are right now.
Exactly.
At this moment, it runs basically the length of the center
of
the state.
Well, there's times it's not. I mean, it knocked like I think the from the 23rd arch on at the San Ynez Mission, the whole end of the mission fell down in an earthquake. I didn't look any of this stuff. It might have been like 1807 or somewhere in there. There was a hell of an earthquake knocked down that one. I think it knocked down Parisima in Lompoc too. So there are times when it maybe hits just wrong and the thing goes down. But that happens even today. Look at the Sylmar earthquake and all those places.
Sure.
So even our big highways can have trouble, you know. So
we'll be back with more of Emil Franzi's Voices of the West right after these messages.
Emil Franzi's Voices of the West will be right back.
Let's face it, nobody wants to get old, but it's a fact of life. It's going to happen. So with that in mind, you need to plan for the inevitable for you and for your loved ones. That's why you should consult attorneys Ron Zach and Chanel Schmitz. Their practice is all about elder law, putting together wills and trusts, and estate planning. They're committed to make a difference for you and your loved ones. Let them help you plan for the future. Call 520-664-3420 or visit them on the web at TucsonEstatePlanning.com. That's 520-664-3420 or TucsonEstatePlanning.com.
Imus Wilkinson Investments, 777-1911, is a unique investment management firm. They pay little attention to where the market indicators are because smart investment management goes way beyond checking stock exchanges. They are very good at managing all types of investment based on client expectations. They build relationships, and they want clients, not customers. My family is proudly included among them, and they'll help you, as they did us, design a portfolio that achieves what you want when you need it. Imus Wilkinson Investments, they're really good at what they do. 777-1911.
Are you partial to the Old West of its ways? Like watching Old West movies with cowboys running cattle over sprawling rangeland? Do you have a passion for Old West history? If you answered yes to any of those questions, then you ought to join the Empire Ranch Foundation as a member. The nonprofit was started to help preserve the historic Empire Ranch in Southeast Arizona and the ways of the Old West. It's one of the last great cattle ranches of the Old West and the site for numerous movies like Monty Walsh, Red River, and The 310 to Yuma. Your membership will help preserve the historic ranch buildings, get you special ticket prices to all Empire Ranch events, and being with others who share your passion for the Old West. Learn more at EmpireRanchFoundation.org or call 888-364-2829. That's EmpireRanchFoundation.org or 888-364-2829.
Welcome back to Emil Franzi's Voices of the West.
And now back to Voices of the West with guest Dana Merrill of the Pomar Junction Vineyards and Winery, located in Central California.
So let's talk about the about wine growing or grape growing.
Yeah.
And your family was involved. They did grow the grape back when they first settled the area? Is that right?
Yep, long time ago, but there really wasn't any. There wasn't any grape farming left by the time I came along. And to be honest with you, it was a. When I was going to Cal Poly, so we're talking about the early 70s, the wine grape business was just getting restarted, if you will, because Prohibition really knocked the heck out of the wine business. You know, everything was done. And so. In Solvang, you had Firestone came and they planted grapes, and there were a few others, Saca Mesa, and some investment firms in Santa Maria, and then they were starting to go into Monterey and so on. So it was kind of a rebirth of the wine grape industry. So, you know, I took a couple of courses when I went to Cal Poly. I took ag business. I mean, I was more of a field crop vegetable guy. Thinking like, I don't know about this grape thing, if it'll ever really catch on, you know. Cause, I mean, really, the wine everybody was drinking then was like Tyrolia and Pink Chablis and that kind of thing. But, you know, it got started, and then I went to Cal Poly, and I got the green ag business, and my brother and I decided we're going to lease land, and we were raising a lot of alfalfa, and we'd sell them to dairies in Santa Maria, and some horse. There were a lot of horses in San Jose too, but the dairies were more consistent pay, not to say anything bad about the horse people, but every once in a while, a guy come in with this beautiful truck with dual wheels and a name on the side, and the check for $24 would bounce. I mean, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas the dairies were good, solid people. There used to be like 30 dairies in Santa Maria. None left now. And we raise alfalfa, and then we raise canning tomatoes and sugared beets, all kinds of stuff, lima beans, stuff like that. Meanwhile, the grape guys were doing their thing. But by the time we got to the end of, you know, fun years like the grain embargo with Russia and what the heck else happened, we had inflation that was just hyperinflation, you know, fuel and everything else. My brother and I concluded we were not going to make it with this thing. So we went out. He went to work in, Kevin went to work for Salyer over in Corcoran. We were talking about Corcoran. He went over there and got a job there, and which was an interesting experience. And I wound up going to work for a big wine grape outfit in King City. It was the largest vineyard in the world at the time. And it was an equity investment by Prudential Insurance Company. And the McCarthy Farming Company of Fresno had developed it for them. And they had done some other big projects, you know, far away as Australia and sugar and Louisiana and all kinds of stuff. But anyway, they were believing that time. Time magazine, I guess, had an article in 1970 that basically said once Americans drink as much as the French do and go from, like, drinking a cup of wine a day to drinking 34 gallons, you know, a person, this thing's got nowhere to go but up. And then they found out that it was going to take a long time to get people to drink that much wine, and the whole Midwest wasn't sure you should even say the word wine or you might go to hell immediately. So anyway, it took a lot longer than they thought. Eventually, the wine did catch on, and also Americans' palates grew to know what good wine was and appreciate it. And of course, all the restaurant scene changed and everything else to make it go. But when I went to Cal Poly, I took a couple of wine grape courses, and it's particularly interesting to me this week because we just broke ground for a brand new wine and vit center at Cal Poly. Cal Poly has grown into the largest wine and vit major in the U.S. I mean, it's bigger than Davis, bigger than Fresno State, but they had no facilities. I mean, they're a very successful ag school, but nobody ever thought about grapes there, you know. And so now it's got a very successful wine. And you know, it's an evolution of crops to go from, you know, you go from barley and grain, and you go to almonds, you go to walnuts, you go to these different things. There's always going to be something new and something that you got to learn about. And so Cal Poly got into gear. And today, if you want to have buildings at a campus like Cal Poly, you go do some fundraising in your industry, and you get to have the buildings. The state doesn't pay for anything anymore. So we finally, I'll give a plug for Jerry Lohr, my fellow winemaker from Paso Robles, who's a wonderful guy, and very, very engaged in the industry, and puts countless hours to fundraising for research, or in this case, Cal Poly. And he's 81 years old, and he could have more energy all three of us put together. But anyway, we've got this. We just broke ground last week. In fact, I have my gold shovel at home in the garage, and we're sure to do a beautiful gold. I got to put it up here in the office somewhere. And so we dug the first double shovel for there. Things going to be operational, so the students will have a decent place to study and all that. So it's come a long, long way to where now it's really a great crop for the area. And one of the reasons it is that wine grapes will grow in the poorer soil. So in other words, you don't grow wine grapes where you grow lettuce and broccoli and all that stuff like you see in Oceano or Santa Maria or strawberries. All right, those crops are in a different world. But you can grow it on poorer, thinner soils that frankly wouldn't be agriculture anymore. I mean, we weren't going to raise dry land grain anymore. It'd be really gotten down to the point where the government would pay farmers not to grow anything, which is fine for the guy getting the check. Well, I think he would probably still rather be farming. But nonetheless, at least he gets sustenance. But it kills communities. And Paso Robles, by the end of the 60s, was a dying town in many ways. I mean, no car dealers closing, no more tractor dealers. You know, not really ag country anymore because there isn't any viable ag left. You know, cattle guys hang on, but you know, it's just not intensive agriculture. So wine grapes came along, value-added product, grows on the poor soils, and uses the least amount of water of any crop there is, other than maybe cactus. But, I mean, literally, wine grapes use like a fourth of the water of any of these other crops, which comes in handy when you're now entering decades of drought, apparently, and we have a lot more people and everything else going on. So it was a godsend. You know, I look at myself personally, I wouldn't be in the farming business if I hadn't found wine grapes, or at least I wouldn't be in the farming business here. I might be in the farming business somewhere, but I wouldn't be doing it here. And it's offered up a chance. We have a company that manages vineyards for institutional landowners. it allows me to use a lot of my budgeting skills and you know, labor management and all that kind of stuff. And also we have the family winery that we get to have our own brand on a bottle of wine to show what, you know, 100% of our vineyard and our efforts and our grapes taste like in a bottle of wine made in our own facility on the ranch. And that's pretty neat. You know, it's a way of you know, keeping some business local. And it just isn't all, the grapes aren't all shipped to some, you know, big winery over in the San Joaquin Valley, and then you lose all identity. I mean, here you can literally go to wineries around Paso Robles and other parts of California and other places. Actually, wine's made in all 50 states now, but California still leads the pack by a wide margin. You know, you can go out there, talk to the winemaker how he made it. You can come out here, like, when the stuff's coming in, see it crushed, you know, hear about how it ferments and taste out of the barrels. And it's it fits real well with, you know, growing food closer to the table, whether it's vegetables and that kind of thing, or it's a glass of wine, a very natural product.
Going back to some, shall we say, the days of your grandparents and your ancestors in the Spanish, shall we say, heraldry days, you know, there's a big argument amongst barbecue people that barbecue, you know, setting aside American Southern barbecue, yeah, the originators of barbecue, because you have the French who say that they created barbecue because it, the word barbecue goes from the barb of the beard of the goat to the queue being the curly tail. But then you have the Spanish and or the Mexicans, especially if you go down into Texas, who say, no. We Spaniards created barbecue. We have a word for it. It's called barbacoa. Mm-hmm. So, and I know that in San Luis Obispo is a famous, famous place called McClintock's, which specializes in Santa Maria style barbecue. Mm-hmm. So was there, did you ever hear any of that, or did you guys have those type of big barbecues?
Yeah, barbecues at my, when I was, before we got into the kind of like the one that we had last time, where you're cooking on a grill and all that stuff, we always did a lot with oak. In fact, I didn't start cooking on gas barbecues until probably like 10 years ago. Actually, it's probably a lot better for your health. But anyway, I'm just eating all the charcoal and oak bark is the best, by the way. White oak, or these oaks that grow around here,
especially
if it's a really old oak tree where the bark's this thick.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it. I mean, if you just throw a couple of pieces in a regular charcoal thing, I mean, there's just nothing like it. But what I recall is the two other ways that they cooked down there was they would cook like a pig, and it would be in the ground.
Covered.
That was one way they did it. And then the other, they'd have these great big long hook, or almost like a spear with a big thing on the end of it. And they put all these steaks and chops and everything on the thing, and it would sit over the fire, and then they would turn it by hand, or, you know, and that's
very
basically
slowly
how they, yeah, that was basically how they used to barbecue, because I know my grandfather never had like a barbecue from Sears that you put it on top of the grill thing. I mean, that's like, who did that?
He didn't have a Weber on the back porch.
No. So the other thing is they would be, you know, again, which I think I kind of get a kick out of the things we had like last night, you know, where you have a bunch of people get together and the group turns out that at the beginning you didn't know that you were going to have a group at all. And it turns out when it's all done, there's like 20 people there, you know, or more. I mean, that table we have there is missing two leaves. And a lot of times people come in, they laugh at it. Oh, what do you guys, you sit at one end of it? I said, I tell you what, we can fill this thing up pretty damn fast. Between the wine business, the farming business, and your family, and then you get extended relatives, and you know, that thing's full. And that's really what the guy built that house intended that place to be for. You have that, and you have a game room, and a big kitchen, and what else is life about?
I mean, well, and you know, all you have to do is mention meat,
yes,
beef,
exactly,
and people come running from the hills.
So I think that I don't think you can say it all just came from France, and that would.
I would agree. I mean, the Spaniards have a word for it. So I think that gives a lot of credence to some ownership of it.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Dana Merrill for sharing stories about the history of his family. And thanks for listening. For Todd Roberts, I'm Harry Alexander. Tune in next week for another edition of Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to Emil Franzing's Voices of the West.